This podcast is supported by an independent educational grant from Ipsen.
Welcome to our podcast, where we're going to talk about shared decision-making in your enterprise teams, NETs, how to individualize patient treatment and factors associated with that. I'm Dr. Mohd Khan. I'm a consultant gastroenterologist and lead at the Neuroendocrine Tumor Service of South Wales. And this is Sally.
Hello, I'm Sally Jenkins. I'm a NET patient of 15 years standing. I've learned to live with it. It's changed my normality, but I now have a different one. And over the years, I've been quite involved with patient support, patient groups, and also advocacy.
Tell me about your experience from the start.
Right, goes back 15 years. I was diagnosed in 2009, but before that, for a couple of years, I'd been having increasingly severe symptoms, but they were rather non-specific. So it was mainly pain, abdominal pain, diarrhea, feelings of tiredness, and a very slow weight loss. But it was, as I say, very non-specific. So I was one of these patients that was in and out of the GP surgery, one of the revolving door type of patients. And I went through all sorts of tests, none of which actually showed anything. And so I was beginning to wonder whether I was actually making it all up or whether, you know, whether I turned into a middle-aged well woman that was inventing all these different symptoms. But then just at the end of 2008, I thought, I'm going to do something serious about this. And early in 2009, I had a private CT scan and something showed up there. But before anything could be done, I actually saw a surgeon and I was scheduled for routine surgery. But before anything could be done, nature took over and the NETs turned ischemic. In other words, they blocked a blood vessel in my abdomen and I became really ill. So I was blue lighted into the local hospital and had emergency surgery. So I was in hospital for a couple of months. And when I came out, I was minus quite a large amount of small bowel. Also minus some large bowel, I had a stoma and I was being fed through a tube that went in through the chest here. So I went home for 7 months and then I was one of the fortunate ones that could have the surgery reversed. So I lost the stoma, but for a short while, it was touch and go whether I still had enough digestive system left to actually survive without artificial feeding. Again, I was one of the lucky ones. I can survive just eating ordinarily, even though I do have quite a lot of restrictions about what I can eat. But that was not the end of the story. Although I was medically stable and I was given injections to stop the NETs that were still left because there were a lot that were inoperable and are still there. I was given injections to stop them progressing. But my condition was not particularly well managed because I didn't really have access to specific NET expertise at that time. So I still had very similar symptoms to before diagnosis. And that was getting abdominal pain and that was necessitating admission into hospital. I still had a lot of diarrhea. And I was still tired. But then after a couple of years, I was very fortunate I did gain access to NET expertise. And when that happened, my life just changed completely because the condition was managed correctly. And so that took about a year to sort out, including having something called an ERCP, which is a fancy type of gastroscope, which solved the abdominal pain problems, because what had been happening was that it was assumed that these pains were to do with my condition, and in fact they weren't. It was something completely different. So it took a NET specialist, I'm thinking outside the box, to actually sort everything out. Then after those couple of years, there was still no specialist NET service in my area, so I was referred out to a centre of excellence. And things continued very stable for years, which was really great. I couldn't go back to a normal life. I never have done. But I could establish a new normality. So things stayed stable for about 10 years. And then the NET started moving again, started growing. Now, that is not a disaster because there's something called PRRT, which is a nuclear therapy. I had that. It needed 4 doses, 3 months apart over the period of a year. And that happened during lockdown. And I have to hand it to the NHS. Lockdown did not stop them. It just kept carrying on as if nothing was happening. So it didn't affect my treatment at all. Even though I was having to go up to London to have it done, and I was mildly radioactive after each dose, but it did what it said on the tin. It stabilised the tumours, and they have stayed stable since then. That was in 2020. I forgot to mention, between the time when I was transferred out to the Centre of Excellence and the PRRT, I was so stable that I was able to have things like a hip operation. I had a hip replacement. So life can continue very much normally, even with a quite severe cancer.
Thank you, Sally. It's a summary of a very long story.
Yeah.
Throughout that story, you've had lots of consultations, various modes. And what makes a good consultation?
It's if the person on the other side of the table is listening to you. That is really the main thing. And also has the expertise that is necessary. Because in the beginning, before I actually got in touch with anybody that had NET expertise, I was treated by very competent people, but they weren't specialists. And so sometimes I would go into the room and the doctor would actually say to me things like, well, I'm not sure of the details of your cancer. Can you tell me what you know? Now, that's not what you want to hear from a specialist, because for the previous couple of months, you will have been thinking, oh, I wonder what this is, I wonder what that is. And you store up all those questions. And when you get to the expert, you want the expert to actually have comprehensive knowledge. So if they try and blag it, you can really suss that out pretty quickly. If you know that that person has a certain amount of knowledge, but is willing to admit that they don't know everything and that they will find it out for you, then confidence increases. And you know then that they're listening to you and that they have the knowledge to be able to treat you competently.
So that knowledge and expertise instills a confidence,
yeah,
in yourself.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, as a patient. And are there any other factors that make you think, oh, that was a good consultation or a bad consultation?
I think when you walk through the door, in the first 30 seconds, you establish whether or not it's going to be good. And it's all to do, I think, with body language. If your doctor is looking at you and has your attention, you are, you know, his focus or her focus.
Rather than looking at the computer.
Yeah, rather than looking at the computer or whatever, treats you as a human being. A smile always helps, even if they've got the cares of the world on their shoulders. A smile for you is actually quite important, because even though patients appear confident, and I've met hundreds of NET patients now in various meetings and support groups, underneath it all, we are nervous. We may not show it and we may not say it, but we are quite worried, even if it's buried very deep. So if when you walk through the door, you think, oh yeah, this person's on my side and is going to listen to me, then that sets everything off to a good start. And that is down to expression and body language.
So communication skills, and then I said, probably from the clinician perspective, communication skills been taught nowadays at medical school, to varying degrees and throughout the world. And, you know, I've always thought that communication skills and how you make the patient feel really important. So from my perspective as a clinician, obviously the consultation, there's a goal to the consultation, but which is relaying information or answering questions. There's all sorts of different types of consultation. And also different types of patients and people. Mm-hmm. Patients are, you know, I'm a patient and I've had quite a lot of different types of consultation myself. And everyone's different, I think. And
yeah.
One person is different to another person. And it's a, you know, a range of personalities throughout society that are represented. And yeah, probably found that difficult initially years and years ago. But I think something for clinicians, which I've learned over the years, trying to be adaptable to the patient. Mm. Some patients come to me and go, doctor, just tell me how it is or tell me what to do. But then some people want to be really involved. And the goals of the consultation, I think, are quite important from a patient perspective. How do you feel about setting out goals at the beginning of a consultation?
I find that really useful. Yeah. The consultations that I've been through have changed over the years, because in the beginning, it's novelty and, you know, you want lots of information quickly. And you need, I always found that I wanted to be told what to do, because I thought that, you know, the experts know what they're doing. I just need that. As I've gone on, now that I've got more expertise myself, I want information, but sometimes I need it spread out in a slightly different way. But it's always useful at the beginning to know that you've got common goals. And so, you know, saying, well, in this consultation, we're going to discuss this, 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 and this. Are you happy with that to the patient? Is reassuring. And it also gives you something at the end that you can review and go over and say, oh, yes, well, we've come to this decision and that decision and what decision. And that will sometimes spark another question, because something that we do an awful lot of, and I've done it myself even after 15 years, is I have this total blank halfway through. I've got a whole list of questions. They are written down on a bit of paper. I practiced them before. But I'll still leave them out. And so sometimes that reviewing the goals will spark a question that otherwise could have been left out.
I think that's important. I've felt that as a patient myself. I will often leave the consultation and forgotten that I wish I'd asked that. So I have then, you know, over the years, thought about that in consultations with patients who, at the end, I'll offer a chance of them. Have you understood everything? Are you happy with this plan? Have you got any questions to ask? And then knowing if they think about it and they're not sure and they're thinking, I'll actually use the computer and do some requests and things whilst it gives them a little chance to think about questions, and also offer them afterwards at the end, saying, well, if you have any questions afterwards, we have a nurse specialist, so there's an opportunity at some point in the future to ask those questions. Mm.
That's really good, because what it does, it takes the pressure off. And when you're more relaxed, then you do remember things. But that little thing that you just said of turning away and maybe writing something on the computer, it gives you just that little chance, if you're relaxed and comfortable, to think, oh yeah, that last question that came up. The other thing that is useful, and you know, you see it on an awful lot of websites and discussion things, is write your questions down before you go. Don't be afraid to get a pen and paper out and show them. You know, go down and say, well, do you mind if I ask you these questions? Write down answers. But also, if you have somebody with you who is also briefed and can prompt, you know, somebody that you're comfortable with, and if the clinician welcomes them as well and includes them, then that all adds to the atmosphere of being relaxed, because being relaxed and confident, I think, is the key.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And there's what we want is the patient and the relatives or friends or carers to be comfortable enough to ask those questions at the end. Mm-hmm. And quite often people will have a list of questions and they'll bring that out at the end. And I guess I asked about what makes a good consultation. Quite a lot of the time, if they bring out a list of questions at the end and they've gone through to the end and actually go, oh, well, actually you've covered everything, then I think then at least I've enabled a good consultation or a relaxed consultation, so that there's enough information that they can go away and feel that they've got confidence in us, the whole service.
Mm. Yeah, also having the option to ring back later. That's really important to get back to a CNS. And you know that the CNS will also have access then to the clinician. So if you've really forgotten something, you can always go back.
So shared decision-making and individualised preferences, what are your goals? What's the most important sort of points in and goals and preferences in shared decision-making from a patient perspective?
I think from the patient point of view, it's all to do with a feeling of control. As we've said earlier, sometimes patients do want to be told what to do, but even those who think they need instruction do like to have a little bit of choice. And I think with NETS, there are so many different pathways. Different patients have different pathways, but then there are options even for one particular patient. I think I'm right
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's no right or wrong answer, which is what I tell quite a few patients.
It's just a balance of probabilities that one might work a bit better than that one, or doing nothing might be okay.
Yeah, I mean, we've got multidisciplinary team meetings where there's lots of specialists involved. In neuroendocrine tumours, who will have a consensus, where then it's the senior responsible clinician's duty to involve the patient in discussion during the consultation. And really, I think it's up to the clinician to offer those options and say, well, there are alternatives, but this is the preferred option. And sometimes it's also relaying the fact there's no certainty and weighing up pros and cons of each. And as you say, if you have different patients and they've got the same type of NET and the same sort of stage, etc., there are other factors involved that the patient might bring to the table to influence what the best shared decision is. For example, there are patients that have their lives affect, everyone's life is affected by neuroendocrine tumour and the people around them. And there's work and family and travel involved, which decisions can affect. I mean, have you had that experience yourself?
Yes, I have. It had a huge effect on my family. When I was diagnosed, I was a wife, mother, daughter in university, a lecturer. I had a very busy life. That all disappeared, and it affected the whole family around me and all my colleagues. And so the timing of some treatments made a lot of difference. You know, I was a lecturer, so life during the summer wasn't as pressured as during term time. And if you can fit choices in around that, it makes a huge, huge difference. The other thing that I've noticed as well, not so much with me, but it's been a few of my fellow patients have mentioned it, is travel. And particularly controlling symptoms, because it's very difficult to travel if you have to be in the loo every half hour. Now, just the simple thing of getting the balance of medication right and having the choice to do that can make a lot of difference. And even being told things like, well, have you heard of the radar key scheme? You know, that made a huge difference to a fellow patient. Before, they weren't going on holidays. But when they heard about that, they said, yeah, we'll go, because confidence, it was a matter of confidence. But all those little things that you can adjust them slightly and they will turn into a viable life. Whereas if they're not adjusted, then you haven't got a viable life. And that is really important to the patient.
So there are life-changing factors involved in shared decision-making. And I guess you're referring to the radar key, which is in the United Kingdom,
yeah,
which allows you access
to toilets
that are locked in public places. Mm. So that's a sort of a preference influencing factor in shared decision making. Are there any other sort of goals and preferences that you think yourself or patients may have which would affect shared decision making? I mean, I guess from my perspective, I know that people are different, and as you say, some people just want a doctor or clinician just to make a decision because they don't maybe either understand the information, even if it's relayed in a very simple way, or are used to someone just making a decision for them, whereas some people want to get very, very involved and want all the information, and judging how much information someone wants before making that decision together or delegate that decision to really important.
That's something that I've always admired doctors for, because you have to sum up quite quickly how much information a patient needs. And giving them too much will frighten the living daylights out of some. But you've got to do that almost instantaneously. And that must be quite difficult to do. I've always admired that, because it's such a close call, but it makes an awful lot of difference to a person. And, you know, some people want to know whether a particular test, the number was 58 or 57, and to them it makes a huge amount of difference, where the others will just want to know, okay, it's in the normal range, and they're happy with that. And you've actually got to get that, you've got to judge that and get that across.
It is a difficult skill, which you have to check in the beginning of the consultation. And,
how do you do that?
I mean, I think it's just I think it comes from experience and setting the goals right at the beginning of the consultation, that introduction thing we talked about earlier, and making people feel relaxed, then I think it's a sort of human factor skill, being able to judge how much we ask people, but sometimes people are anxious and worried, and there's always opportunities afterwards to get more information, as you say, because ultimately, if we get to the point of shared decision making, if someone legally in England and Wales for consent to a decision for treatment, the patient needs to have the capacity to make the decision, has to have all the relevant information and also the alternatives and material risks. So if there's side effects particular treatment, then we have to mention them, because as you gave an example of someone who couldn't travel because they were having lots of diarrhea and so therefore were worried if an injection, move on to injections, injection could cause a bit of side effects with diarrhea.
Yeah.
If that patient can't move very quickly and they're on a walking stick, dodgy hip, and can't get to the toilet in time, then that could really impact their lives if they're getting running stools and have to rush to go to the toilet. So being able to express that, knowing that patient will think that's important for them, we have to be able to give all that relevant information so we can have a shared decision.
That's another point I just thought of. It's quite an embarrassing subject, and a lot of patients, particularly when they're newly diagnosed, they just don't like mentioning it.
Yeah,
I've got to go to a lot in a quiet voice, and we notice it a lot at patient meetings. You can tell the old hands, because by the time you've been there half a dozen times, you are discussing your toilet habits and telling funny stories about it, and that really does help. But in the beginning, there can be quite a lot of embarrassment, and patients just don't want to say anything. So it takes quite a lot of skill from the doctor to make them relax and elicit that from them and let them know that actually it's normal.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I'm talking about bowels most of my life.
Yeah.
As a gastroenterologist, I think it's an important point to make. And I think there's also a cultural thing, generational differences, etc. Mm-hmm. Lots of factors that other people are experts in than myself. When I moved across from London to Wales, I brought a paper questionnaire, which was used at a previous institution for other things, not for cancer, and it allowed people just in the waiting room to tick some boxes with some, so that they don't have to express themselves if there's certain things they might feel embarrassed about. Now we've got digital versions of that, and
yeah.
I know we'll talk about patient outcomes in a moment. But
yeah, I can remember that. That's really good. That, again, you can hand the information over without embarrassment, and then there's the grounds for discussion. You know, the doctor can open the subject, and it's not embarrassing then.
Thanks, Ali. Interesting conversation. So as we come to the end of this podcast, I'd like to leave the audience with some concluding points. So what do you think the takeaways of our conversation have been?
From the patient's point of view, what patients want and need, I feel, is to feel that they are being listened to carefully and that they're views are being taken into account, because what that does is give back a feeling of control that something like a cancer diagnosis takes away.
And from the clinician perspective, it's communication skills, empathy, ability to tailor the consultation and information, and tailoring the shared decision making to the situation and the patient, because people are different. So I think we've covered quite a lot today. So thank you very much, Sally.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to find out more, then please look for the Oncology Medical Conversation podcast under the account of Core2Ed Medical Education. Also, don't forget to rate this podcast, subscribe to our channel, and share it with your colleagues. Thank you for listening and see you next time. This podcast is an initiative of Core2Ed and developed by NetConnect, a group of international experts working in the field of neuroendocrine tumors. The views expressed are the personal opinions of the experts, and they do not necessarily represent the views of the experts' organizations or the rest of the NetConnect group. For expert disclosures on any conflict of interest, please visit the Courtois website.